Hello there. Today is Thursday, August 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. and global stocks plunge with rising fears of an economic recession.
There's no reason for anyone to lose any sleep or buy canned goods.
Protesters in Hong Kong close off the airport, demanding democratic policies. Also ahead, what Lady Gaga is doing to ease the suffering of school children in cities impacted by mass shootings. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. U.S. stocks fell almost 3% in major equity indices, and Europe closed down 2% Wednesday, while crude prices slumped almost 5% at one point after a closely watched economic indicator pointed to the growing risk of a U.S. recession. It was heightened by data showing Germany's economy in contraction and China's worsening as well. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Morghani explains.
It's called a yield curve inversion, a market phenomenon showing yields on 2- and 10-year Treasury notes inverted early today. That means investors want more in return for short-term government bonds than for long-term ones. It's a significant indicator investors have lost faith in the economy's soundness. Inversions like this have preceded the last 9 recessions going back to 1955.
But Bankrate.com analyst Mark Hamrick explains the U.S. trade war and other factors are creating economic unease.
Trade tensions and burgeoning tariffs being front and center, there's a weakening global economy, and so it only stands to reason that the risks are also rising for the U.S. economy.
But he says people shouldn't rush to take their money out of the stock market.
There's no reason for anyone to lose any sleep or buy canned goods because of this yield curve inversion. We know that the economy will not grow forever. It's just a question of when the downturn arrives, and that could easily be more than a year off.
The Dow Jones suffered its worst drop in 2019, plunging 800 points. President Trump said this week he would delay a 10% tariff on cell phones, laptops, and other consumer goods until mid-December, quote, just in case the duty would have an impact on consumer spending during the Christmas season. Hong Kong's airport reopened and flights resumed Wednesday after riot police clashed with pro-democracy demonstrators Tuesday evening following a second straight day of canceled flights. The airport protests over the past 2 days are part of 10 weeks of demonstrations by Hong Kong residents against their perceived erosion of freedom and lack of autonomy under Chinese control of the territory. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with reporter Aaron Hale at the airport in Hong Kong about the protests and what started Tuesday's violence.
As I understand it, protesters first discovered that there was an undercover officer amongst them, and it got very heated with them yelling at them. And then at some point, they also discovered that one amongst them was a Global Times reporter, which is, of course, the state news outlet for China, and they were very upset by that. So there was a lot of yelling at these people. And then sometime after 11, about a dozen police officers came in the usual uniform, in the blue uniform, and they stood on the sort of near the entrance, and they were shouted down by protesters, and they retreated. And then about an hour later, maybe half an hour later, riot police suddenly showed up, and it was very, very intense, very fast. And they came in, and they took out the officer, and they also, at some time after that, medics took away the Global Times reporter, and then things calmed down and most people are leaving. And the SCMP is reporting that an injunction has been issued against the protesters, although they haven't cited their sources.
And what do you expect to happen as far as that's concerned? Do you expect the protest to go on?
Well, that now means that the police do have grounds to enter and remove people. So that's a pretty big warning to the protesters. I initially thought riot police might come back tonight. A lot of people say no. There's still a lot of passengers in the airport. Most of the protesters have left, but it looks like a lot of flights are still coming in right now.
How dangerous is this? I mean, you've been in Hong Kong for a while now. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
I mean, I think we're in unknown territory. I was here during the Umbrella Movement, and that had some violent skirmishes, but that was pretty peaceful. This is something entirely, especially on Sunday, with police really getting increasingly angry and just violent with protesters and very quick to draw sort of unrestrained force. I think they're kind of going past what their guidelines are. You know, they fired at protesters when they clearly weren't being threatened. And so it's really getting quite intense here.
What is the overall feeling in Hong Kong? Is there great support for the protest, or is that switching as you can see it?
I think a lot of people don't support all the tactics of the protesters, and they'll be very quick to say that, especially when they throw bricks at police officers and they throw, you know, they've lit stuff on fire by them. But overall, I think the public has actually turned against the police because they've seen, you know, their children getting hurt, they're seeing their grandchildren getting hurt. I think, you know, violence from police officers is not something that people really expect en masse in Hong Kong, and this has really come to shock people.
Do you see any way out?
Unless, you know, Carrie Lam, actually, the leader, actually, you know, meets one or two of their demands, like withdrawing the bill permanently. And I think starting an independent commission into police violence would really go a long way. But the police unions apparently are blocking that. So as far as I can see, there is really no way out except for people get really tired and, you know, maybe then they go back to school. It's kind of like a war of attrition right now.
What's the position or what is are the actions, if you know, and you might not, of both China and then the triads, which beat people up a few weeks ago?
There is, hasn't been fully proven, but people do think that the triads had come out and beat protesters on September 21st, and the police did not reply to 911 calls when that happened. So there's belief that there is some collusion there. And then similar people were seen this weekend beating up reporters. And now the conspiracy theory is that we have these pro-China triad people working behest of Beijing. But, you know, this is all conspiracy theories. It could be true, but maybe there's a grain of truth, but it's really hard to say.
And what has this done to Hong Kong in your mind? Hong Kong has been known as being peaceful, being successful, a great place for business. What has this done?
I think it's really changed what people think of the city. You know, we've seen unprecedented levels of violence. The UN issued a statement today about police tactics and brutality. And, you know, its reputation is as one of the most stable cities in Asia and as a financial hub. And I think that is probably permanently changed. I think a lot of people are actually impressed with the protesters and how organized they are. But everyone's very worried that we could see, you know, 1989 again.
What's the other side of the story, if there is one? Have you considered that? Is there support for Carrie Lam? Is there support for Beijing?
Certainly in the business community, there is support for both Beijing and for Carrie Lam. Whether or not they've been pushed that way to say that is uncertain. But I would say that probably wealthier sectors of Hong Kong society are unhappy with this. And they just want to kind of get on with big business. And there's probably a lot of ordinary people as well who, you know, think these kids are annoying and should just go home.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. American families are seeking clues about their enslaved ancestors. Russia flies a nuclear-capable bombers to the region facing Alaska. Tunisia's first gay presidential candidate faces threats from extremists. And a former NBA All-Star pays it forward to South Sudan's youth. Find expanded coverage of these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. As the Trump administration continues its hardline immigration policies, recent U.S. raids have apprehended over 100,000 undocumented immigrants working at factories and job sites in the last year. But on average, only about 15 employers per year face any criminal charges for hiring undocumented workers. VOA's Brian Padden reports that both advocates and opponents of stricter immigration restrictions argue that high-profile raids will do little to deter immigration as long as employers are not held accountable.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents recently raided 7 agricultural processing plants in the state of Mississippi, arresting some 680 designated removable aliens who were unlawfully working at the plants. Yet few of these companies are likely to be charged for violating federal statutes on the unlawful employment of aliens because it is usually difficult to prove they had prior knowledge their workers were in the country illegally. Penalties for hiring undocumented workers range from $100 per violation to $10,000 and up to 6 months in prison for multiple infractions. Anti-immigration groups say the lack of strong enforcement against business owners is failing to cut off a key incentive for illegal immigration: jobs.
We're attacking the limbs. We're not attacking the root of the problem.
Many companies utilize the E-Verify system, a voluntary government program that checks the legal status of workers. But even pro-business advocates admit it is a flawed system because fraudulent documents often go unchallenged, while at the same time giving employers legal cover to maintain their workforce.
My number one theory about E-Verify is that it doesn't work, and that's the only reason why it's popular, because politicians can look tough while pushing it, but know that it won't harm the local economy.
Immigrant rights groups object to working migrants being treated as criminals. Pro-business supporters want legal immigration expanded to address the labor shortage in the U.S.
The number one policy we need is to make it possible for lower and mid-skilled workers to be able to come to this country legally, to be able to work for a term of time, and then to be able to go back to their home countries.
Anti-immigration proponents dispute there is a labor shortage, only an unwillingness to pay living wages to workers, and want business owners to face more than the occasional fine for hiring undocumented immigrants.
They factor that in as a cost of doing business. And that has to change. And the only thing that will change that, I think, are severe penalties that could result in jail.
Both immigration critics and advocates agree enforcement measures have been ineffective, but there continues to be no consensus on how to reform the system. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
Well, about 650 million children and women worldwide were married before the age of 18. That's about 17% of the world's female population, according to UNICEF. These marriages often limit girls from completing their education and can lead to devastating psychological and physical consequences. In a year-long project, Voice of America met with child brides from Albania to Pakistan to Tanzania. Jesusman Oni has more.
11-year-old Bubblegai went from selling firewood and paper to becoming a wife so she could settle her mother's debt.
I was crying. I wanted someone to help, but we had no choice. The lenders were pressing hard.
More than 12 million underage girls like her get married every year, according to UNICEF.
I had not begun menstruating when I married. I started in my husband's house.
Some girls entering into early marriages are under pressure to continue cultural traditions. Others say they had limited options.
I married my daughter off because we had no place to live. Where could I keep her? If I was in a house with her, if I had my own house like now, of course I would have sent her to school. She would not have needed to marry at 11, 12, or 13. She could have been educated, found a job, or learned a trade.
Early marriages happen across societies. In the U.S., most states permit marriage before 18 if the individuals meet certain criteria. However, critics say many of these marriages take place to circumvent statutory rape laws that protect minors.
I met him about when I was like 13, 14. So one thing after another, after a few years, we just kind of ended up together. I got pregnant underage, and that was kind of what had us go ahead and get married so I wouldn't send him to jail.
The young wives are more likely to leave school, experience domestic abuse, and live in poverty compared to those who marry later, according to human rights activists.
I lost my childhood. I loved school and going to school. But they wouldn't let me.
As governments face international pressure to take action, individuals and groups are stepping forward to help young girls.
The night before the wedding, a local official came to our house to ask whether I wanted to marry. When I said no, he halted the ceremony.
Sultan Tumadam found joy in her married life, despite being forced into the union.
I had never met my husband. I didn't know him. With time, we got to know each other. I'm very happy now. thank goodness.
But the case was different for many of the child brides VOA met over the course of this project. Now divorced or deserted, they are angry at losing their education.
I think if I had only continued my studies, I would not have to experience so much harassment from other people now. I could have found a good job.
Now mothers themselves, they say they regret their stolen childhoods and add they never want to see their children married young.
I am now fighting for my children so they don't end up like me. Someone has to fight for them.
The United Nations is trying to eliminate the practice by 2030. Jesus Melny, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. The latest UN climate report underscores the urgent need to protect tropical forests and transform our current model of industrial food production. It also says reducing meat consumption would help curb climate change. But as the demand for meat alternatives is booming, there is a battle of the burgers with a lobby by the meat industry to bar the makers of plant-based foods from calling their products meat. Backers say the proposed measures are intended to protect consumers from misleading labels. It's a strategy that has yielded new legislation in more than two dozen states as meat substitute companies push back. Joining us now to talk more about this is Hana Shanwan, a partner at the international law firm O'Melveny & Myers. And she also specializes in consumer products litigation and teaches U.S. food law and policy at Columbia Law School. Why is the meat industry so concerned about labeling veggie burgers as burgers and veggie hot dogs as hot dogs?
Nothing says, congratulations, you've arrived and you're successful, like a lobbying effort against you by your biggest competitors. There has been a real uptick in plant-based alternatives. The consumer imagination has been really captured by excellent new products on the market that are coming far closer to mimicking the taste and texture and experience of eating meat. And so a number of entrenched interests in the meat industry have lobbied for regulations both at the state court and in the federal government.
Have they gotten any response to these requests?
Sure. So most recently, the state of Arkansas banned companies who make plant-based meat from using words that describe foods that come from animals, like turkey, steak, bacon, burgers, hot dogs, milk. So you wouldn't be able to say, this is a plant-based burger, or this is a tofu dog. You'd have to say, this is the part that's really confusing. What are you going to call it? What do you call something that looks like a hot dog if you're not allowed to use the word hot dog?
Wouldn't the point be to call it a veggie burger or veggie bacon because it's a plant-based alternative that tastes similar to that meat product, and that's how they go about describing it to people that want to buy the product?
Well, the laws that are being put on the books look pretty restrictive, and some of them even have criminal penalties. Those laws seem to restrict using the word burger even if you say plant-based Asperger. So what are you going to call it? Mm. Consumers use those words to understand mm-hmm. the category of product that they're going to get.
It's an interesting concept because who has the market on a burger? Can a burger be a salmon burger or a tofu burger? It's not using the word meat. It's not saying a cow burger.
This issue that you're raising right now underscores how this is really an anti-competitive measure and not an effort to protect consumers from misleading labels, as the proponents of these laws have tended to argue. The proponents of these laws tend to say things like, we don't want consumers to be duped into thinking that a tofu steak is fake. But this just seems, frankly, bonkers to me, because the manufacturers of products like this, they celebrate the fact that these foods are made from plant ingredients. They see that as a competitive advantage. And frankly, the reason customers buy them is exactly because they are made of plants and not from slaughtered meat. It's a big selling point to a whole generation of people who right now love meat but are concerned with the impact on the environment. One of the biggest producers of greenhouse gas emissions comes from animal agriculture. It's bigger than cars, trucks, planes, boats, buses combined. It's the cow industry. And every pound of slaughtered meat uses exponentially more water and resources than a pound of a meat alternative. And so there are a lot of people who want to have the experience of meat, but they want to have that sense that they are contributing to protecting the planet. They are not interested in the traditional meat basis for the burger. And so the notion that these are people who are going to be confused into buying the traditional meat is a little thin.
Demand is obviously going up. There are more and more of these products showing up. A lot of the mainstream companies that strictly sold dairy from a cow or actual meat from an animal, they're also looking at having another product they can offer for people who want this because of the growing demand. So how would this stop the demand, which is continuing to rise?
This is hardly the first time an entrenched industry tries to use labeling laws to knock a competitor back by trying to make the product seem less appetizing. I'll give you an example. So, Lori, do you know what a Pringle is?
I do.
What is a Pringle?
It's a potato chip.
Incorrect. A Pringle is a crisp, and that's because when they launched in the late 60s, they were called Pringles Newfangled Potato Chip. And a bunch of competitors objected that these weren't really potato chips because they weren't sliced off of potato, and the FDA got involved. And in the mid-70s, FDA said that the Pringles could call them potato chips made from dried potatoes. That's not exactly an appetizing label. So what they did is they renamed them Pringles and called them crisps. So if you take out a can of Pringles, you're going to see the word crisp on the side. And that is an example of label changes trying to knock a company out of a category, a very popular, exciting new product, by trying to turn it into something that sounds a lot less appetizing. Some of these companies are fighting back, the ACLU and a couple other organizations, and they have sued the state of Arkansas for their very restrictive meat labeling bill, and they've raised constitutional arguments that this is a violation of free speech. Ultimately, I think consumers are getting a lot of the information they need about these products and that they exist, and the more laws get publicized and then fought back in the court by these different organizations, the more consumers are going to hear about them. It's an odd thing, because by complaining that these products might confuse consumers into thinking that they are actually meat, the people who are against these products are actually doing a fantastic job advertising these products to new consumers, because it shows that they are so nervous that these products are similar in texture and taste and quality that consumers might be confused. And that is a big boost for an industry that is starting to grow by gangbusters.
All right, that is Hannah Shanwan, a partner at international law firm O'Melveny and Meyer. She is also an expert on U.S. food law and policy. Well, as children go back to school in many parts of the U.S. this week, Grammy-winning singer Lady Gaga has pledged to fund students and shake in U.S. communities who've endured recent mass shootings. In El Paso, Texas, there are books for third-grade students, many of whom have none at home. Disabled students in Dayton, Ohio, will get bouncy chairs to help them calm down for learning. Science kits will go to fifth graders in Gilroy, California. Those are just three of a series of local classrooms she's assisting. She says her aim is to bring a measure of hope to places devastated by an extraordinary week of mass shootings in a country numbed by a steady beat of news about gun violence. Gaga announced the donation from her Born This Way Foundation in partnership with nonprofit Donors Choose on Facebook, and she said she hopes to channel her confusion, frustration, and fury into hope. Gaga pledged to fully fund 162 school projects, including requests made by teachers from classrooms in El Paso, Texas, Dayton, Ohio, and Gilroy, California. Back-to-back mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton a week ago left 31 people dead and three more were killed when a gunman opened fire at a food festival in Gilroy, California the previous weekend. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A great deal is lost to history, culture, and economic development when a country does not protect its minority religions and ethnic groups. Sadly, this is what happened in Iraq when government persecution there drove hundreds of thousands of Jews from the country in the early 1950s. Speaking at the Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom, U.S. Agency for International Development Deputy Administrator Bonnie Glick said Jewish Iraqis were driven from their homes to such an extent that an ancient part of the country's cultural and religious landscape is now essentially extinct.
There's no longer a significant Jewish community in Iraq, a land in which some of the most significant Jewish scriptures were originally scribed. There's no longer a significant Jewish community in Iraq, a community that once numbered in the hundreds of thousands because the Iraqi government terrorized its Jewish population and forced them to flee not just their homes and businesses, but the country of their birth.
The persecution of Jews is often a warning sign of more widespread persecution of religious minorities, said Deputy Administrator Glick.
They've been persecuted across the millennia, beginning with the Romans and moving into modern times. Today we see anti-Semitism around the world ranging in places from Buenos Aires, Argentina, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Paris, France, and beyond. And what, if nothing else, stands as a witness to what happens when religious intolerance is allowed to run free. It's the Jewish experience.
The world cannot afford to be silent today as religious communities of Jews, Christians, Yazidis, Muslims, Sikhs, and others are victimized, often by their own fellow citizens, said Deputy Administrator Glick. Thomas Jefferson is often credited with saying that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. That is the hard reality we face today, said Ms. Glick. We must remain vigilant. Nobel Peace Prize winner and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel said the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. And it is critical for the world, said Deputy Administrator Glick, not to be indifferent to the plight of people who are oppressed simply because of their faiths.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News.